Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And a girlfriend of mine sent me, would you like to go to Soho? There's this marvelous person coming. And I got so interested in listening to this gentleman's music. And I thought, okay, I wonder if he would allow an interview. And lo and behold, I have Mike Younger with us. He's coming to Soho October 3rd, which is Monday. The show is 8 to 10, and it's going to be fantastic. I can't wait. It's just my kind of music. And I wanted to talk to Mike a little about the music business. He is a Tennessean, I think. Is that how you say it? Mike, is it Tennessean?
Yeah, I'm a Tennessean by way of New Orleans, New York, and Nova Scotia. But yeah, okay. That's how you say it.
He's born in Tennessee, put it that way. And, it comes from a certain type of music, but it's also the music that he does. Let me see if I can describe it. So
I'm actually born in Nova Scotia, not Tennessee.
You're born in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
Well, you don't. They have an accent up there and they have music up there.
Well, yeah. Sure. A totally different tradition.
Yeah.
Related.
So I'm going to try to describe Mike's music and listen to so much of it last night and tonight. And I had it on my phone because I had a tooth pulled. Can you see? It's all weird.
No, I never would have noticed.
Oh, on this morning I had a tooth pulled and so I had Mike to keep me company listening to mostly. Some of the more recent music, but let me see if I can describe. So there's a couple of different platforms. So Mike doesn't know me, but I come from a dance background. So I was in ballet for many years, and so there's a certain theatricality. And I associate certain performers that have a persona that actually are presenters, they're performers, they're theater people. And when I watch you sing, you are definitely on, you're on stage, your charisma shines. So not a sit back and just relax, you're engaging the audience. So it's a theatrical, in my opinion, a theatrical engaging style. The second part of your music is I haven't listened to one song that doesn't have a message. And the messages are deep and the messages are usually very prescient and they usually involve what our current world is going through as well as things that have to do with on the road and transientness and being a little bit of the outsider looking in. So far that's what I'm getting. The third part of the music is that it is highly evocative of a lot of different styles, mainly based in, I would say, the 1890s to the 1920s. So there's a lot of music, even some of the chord structures. You might say, well, Elizabeth, how do you know this stuff? So I studied music theory, and my mom was a classical pianist, Juilliard graduate, and she brought us all up with years and years of piano. So I have a little bit of music background and history. So there's this theatrical thing, but the theatrical element is in the time of almost like ragtime and vaudeville and that kind of like rinky tink and, kind of like almost like you can almost see. Even though you're listening to very contemporary music, you can see like this little Joker guy in the background with his monkey playing the na 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 na. You know, that's the kind of, it really, on top of it all, beautiful music with gorgeous sound, voice, appearance. I mean, I'm looking at Mike. He's a gorgeous man. He presents like a performer on a stage. There's an acting chops to him, and why I think you're really going to appeal to us here in Santa Barbara is that we are the birthplace of Earth Day. I didn't know if you knew that. So Earth Day was
born. I didn't know that. I've performed many Earth Day festivals over the years. I had no idea that Santa Barbara, I knew that Earth Day was started by an environmental disaster on the West Coast. Yeah. And that was Santa Barbara. I guess I just missed that little detail.
We are the founders of Earth Day. And it goes back, and we have the biggest hooliganist Earth Day parties that go on for 3 days.
I got to make sure to come back when that's happening.
Yeah, you do. So we have Earth Day. We are also the founding organization for Save Our Seas. We are all these, and then of course our university has one of the largest departments in ecology in the world. I mean, we are really super interested in what I hear in your messages, in your songs. So we are the founders of Earth Day. If you look, we had an artist here in our community at the time when, you know, we had the oil well disasters, when artist who was a kind of a pop artist, and he designed that Earth Day logo. So it was one of our local artists, but Earth Day, that's gone all over the world now. And that is our child.
My car makes strange sounds after I've turned it off. It's a ghost in there.
Climate
control. The car is turned off. It stops after a moment. I'm sorry to your listeners. My apologies.
The ghost in the machine. That's another
It's got some module in there that comes on when it feels like later on, after I've shut the car off. It's strange.
The spirit world is entering. So, you know, I want to bring you back to 2001 because I was looking at your career and you had a lineup. Let's see. Levon Helm, you had all kinds of, let's see, Jim Dickman, you had Spooner Oldham, you had a bunch of folks that were gathered around you in 2001.
Yeah.
Take us back to 2001.
Well, I had just released my first album with, you know, that Rodney Crowell produced, and it had gotten up to mid-20s in the AAA charts across the country, and I was doing pretty well for a newbie on the scene, and I was getting ready to make a second record for that record label. And we were I went down to Memphis to meet with a producer that they had recommended. That was Jim Dickinson, and I knew very little about him, but went down there and met him, and he had a bunch of records that he had produced over the years and he'd played on, you know, hanging on the walls of his place. And my reps had kind of tipped me off that he was a heavy, you know, he was like a real player in the whole 60s and 70s rock and roll wave. We didn't have the internet yet back then, or I didn't anyway. I didn't know if it was around in 2001. I wasn't on it at that time. So it wasn't easy for me to do all the kind of research and background on these guys. But anyway, I went down there and I met Jim, and he told me that he really liked the demos that my people had sent over. And he felt there was an authenticity in the music that he could get behind. And while I was there, I mean, I saw on his walls, I saw The Replacements, you know, Pleased to Meet Me. That record with the two hands shaking, that's one that I had when I was like 13 years old. I was so like enamored with that album, and he was the producer, and he had Toots and the Maytals. He did Toots in Memphis. He had Ry Cooter. He had Mink DeVille. He had just an amazing library of projects that he'd worked on. And Arlo Guthrie, he played keys on Good Morning America, How Are You? You know, he played keys on Wild Horses with the Rolling Stones. He played tons of piano with Delaney and Bonnie on all those amazing, you know, just definitive recordings that those folks made in the 60s and early 70s. And he announced his intention of assembling a lineup around me to record the songs that included Levon Helm on the drums and his son, Luther Dickinson, who heads up the North Mississippi All-Stars, and Spooner Oldham, who played keys on Aretha Franklin's early work, David Hood on the bass, who played on When a Man Loves a Woman with Percy Sledge in 1966, and played on Mohair Sam with Slim Harpo in 1959, I think. Like, he must have been a baby, or had like an 18 or 19 year old kid. But I mean, I got to be in the studio. Sorry, jumping ahead of a few moves. Jim announced his intention of putting this crew together, and I was like, hell yeah, I would love that. You know, what do I need to do? And, you know, he told me to just keep refining the songs, and we would schedule it out and make it happen. And, you know, the next thing I knew, I was in the studio with those guys for 3 days. And it was the most magical and wonderful 3 days, for sure. And I got to peek behind the curtain and work with people that I'd been listening to since I was first conscious of our musical culture, you know. And it was a real vindication or confirmation or validation for me. I had spent years and years from when I was about 15, I had started performing in the streets, and I played on subway platforms and street corners and city parks and all that stuff. And for me to finally, I just felt like I was arriving to be in the room, and I'd finally got where I had been headed the whole time, you know, or whatever, you know. I felt like that at the moment. I want to
stop you there, because I know that the other shoe is going to drop, because I know a little bit about this, and Richard's given us that sign that we got to go to quick break.
All right.
Let's go to quick break, and then the denouement is coming, dear listeners, so don't turn that dial. I just reintroduced, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mike Younger, a wonderful musician, in nationally recognized, internationally famous, and he is coming for one night only to Soho, October 3rd, evening performance, and you better get your tickets now. Is all I can tell you. Richard, let's go to quick break. We'll be back in a sec.
All together.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I have the pleasure of speaking with musician, songwriter, I don't know what else, singer, composer, guitarist, world tramp. what else? And the person who walks the walk. We're going to mention something about, let me see here, Standing Rock visit in a few minutes. We're talking with Mike Younger, who's coming to Soho for one performance, just one night only. Hopefully we'll get him back. It's October the 3rd. And you got to get your tickets soon. Otherwise, you'll be standing there just outside underneath thinking, why didn't I buy my ticket? That's all I have to say about that. So now we were talking about 2001, which is a formative year in Mike's career as a musician, where you know, five or six of the greatest musicians in their genre got together and were behind him making these masters. Okay, now take us down the road, Mike.
Well, so we were about 10 songs deep into the recording project, and I arrived to the studio on day four. And the vibe in the studio was pretty different. It wasn't the jovial, lighthearted, fun vibe that we had for the last couple days that we've been recording. And Jim kind of pulled me aside and said, "Mike, can I have a word?" And he pulled me into the other room and said, "We got a call from California from the label, and there's a problem out there. You need to get on it, get your manager on it, and try and sort it out." So I jumped into crisis management mode and got on the phone, and everybody was on the phone there for a little while trying to figure out what was going on. And what had happened was that my record label that I had signed a 6-record deal, of which this was number 2, this was the 2nd record for them. They hit a financial iceberg, and they had to pull in their assets, and they were doing comeback records on a lot of well-known bands, and they were spread thin, and they were surviving on some advances that they were getting through distribution channels. And there was some change in that relationship that really kind of undercut their operation, and they had to pull in their resources. And my project was one of the ones that got abandoned in the field. And I mean, what part of that, the ensuing calamity do you want to know? I mean, there was like the immediate 24 hours, and then there's the, you know, where I was like, I mean, just, you know, so guilt ridden and just shocked and unable to fully digest and wrap my head around the fact that I had all these cats there in the studio and my label was pulling the plug on it. And, you know, it was just a disaster. And then I went back to Nashville. I assured everybody there at the session, I apologized profusely. And I told them that I was going to work on getting it all sorted out and that I wouldn't rest until I did. Little did I know that was true, but it was going to take a lot longer than I imagined in that moment. And so for the next 17 years, that record remained out of reach to me, and my attorney who had negotiated my contract with that record label felt so bad that I was stuck in a 6-record deal that he worked around the clock to get me unstuck, which took a couple of years. And then by that time, the hope of saving the record was long gone. I was just grateful to be able to walk away from the restrictions of the contract and be able to start my career again. And, you know, I picked up the pieces and moved forward making independent albums and stuff. But for a kid that comes up as a street musician to get to work with people of that caliber and then have it all swept off the table into the mist, and not to be, I had the only souvenirs I had from the session was a friend of mine, Hunter Bryce, a great artist who's passed away, great painter from Nashville. He was there to take photos of the session, so I had these black and white Polaroids that he had taken, and there's a bunch of those photographs in the record. Jumping forward again, sorry. So I finally, over the years, Levon passed away, and then Jim passed away, and I realized I was never going to get to listen back to the record that I made with them. We were never going to get to listen back to it together. And I hung with Levon, you know, a half dozen times after that disaster in Memphis, and he always assured me that he didn't hold it. He'd seen enough stuff in the business that he knew it wasn't my doing. But I always carried that guilt with me and told him that I wouldn't rest until I got it sorted out. There goes my car again. And so some 17 years went by from 2001 to 2002 or 2017, sorry. And the owner of the studio, Jack Holder, his obituary comes across my social media. And that studio was had its own temperature and humidity controlled room for all the 2-inch tape that they had. They had many records in there. And with his death came the announcement that the studio would be closing. And I started digging back through memories to remember some of the other people that were around for the session. And I tracked down people in Memphis who I suspected would be charged with caring for those tapes and moving them to a new location and all that stuff. And I was able to make an interception and make a phone call and say, hey, you probably don't remember me, but I made a recording with Levon Helm and Jim Dickinson at your studio almost 20 years ago. And I'd really like to come get it and clear up all of the unsettled business around it and, you know, get the blessing of all the families to move forward to actually put it out into the world. And that's exactly what I did over the last.
That's fantastic. That's a fantastic story. I think a lesser person would be like, nah, you know, I'm a victim. Let me just be a victim the rest of my life.
Oh, I had plenty of that. Believe me. I spent a lot of time trying to make myself forget that it ever happened.
You know what I mean, though. You know, everybody's got somebody in the family or somebody that they were once married to that just, you know, something happens and it's devastating. And it's just like, OK, now I'm living there the rest of my life. I'm not moving.
I do know. I was at risk, Elizabeth, is what I'm saying. I was one of those. I was right on the edge of that. And I think that I lost a lot of time with that in my recovery from that experience, you know. I lost a lot of hope and faith that if I stayed close to the music, it would get me where I needed to be. That was been my operating principle since I was a young boy, started on this journey. And so, you know, to lose faith in your compass is a difficult thing to go through, but I came back to it, you know,
and I get it. You know, is it, I don't know if your press agent said anything, but, you know, my background for 30 years, I've been looking at fine art. I'm an appraiser. So it's like, OK, you know, so you go into the artist studio and, you know, maybe a museum hires me to do the background information on, buying a work of art. And I say to the artist, OK, you know, the contractual agreement and blah, 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 blah. And the accounting in your spreadsheet and the valuation and yada. And he's. Usually here she's like, okay, Dr. Stewart, if I wanted to be an accountant, I would be an accountant. If I want to be a lawyer, I'd be a lawyer. I'm an artist, you know, and it's just, I know there is totally, this is a different world, which is maybe why it's so interesting to me that when that the parts of your music that I seem to gravitate to the most are the innocent, more histrionic bits, which remind me of that honky tonk style. And it's like, okay, then did you really have to worry that much about contracts, spreadsheets, lawyers, about it, that, you know, in 1890? Probably, but not the way we do today. I mean,
no.
And so, okay, I see you, Richard. I see you. I know you're giving us a sign. Are you there? Okay, so we'll go to a quick break. When you get back from the break, I just want to reintroduce. Great honor speaking with Mike Younger, wonderful performer. You're going to see the show on October the 3rd at Soho, and you better get your tickets fast. Anyway, so we're going to talk a little bit with, when we get back from the break, what I want to focus on is, you know, the strong message of environmental action in the light of the fact that we have now in Asia, one of the most devastating storms ever seen by the world, and millions of people evacuated. And it's just like, okay, when are we going to wake up? The second thing I want to talk about is that this is a performer that writes about environmental themes. And there's a wonderful piece about a river in his home state that I want you guys to listen to. But he also walks the walk and talks the talk. I want to talk about him devoting some time and participating in Standing Rock when we get back from the break. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. Back with Mike Younger in a second.
I need you by my side.
Just keeping track of all the enemies. Just pushing back on all.
Welcome
the
back,
ages.
It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with Mike Younger, who's coming to Soho. One performance only, October the 3rd. Tickets are going fast. It's 8 to, well, sorry, I should say the show is 8 to 10, but those of you who know Soho, you know, my plan is to go and get a dinner table. Because then you're closer to the performer. But there's also, you know, there's also the patio area. So there is some overflow, but it's not a big venue. So be aware that if you want to see this wonderful performer, and by the way, what you're hearing in and out of each break, and Richard is putting in Mike's music as throughout the interview. So you're going to hear a little sample as well. But you can also go to Mike Younger on YouTube and take a look at some of the venues he's performed and also some of the really impromptu things that he's done, you know, his background. Yeah, tell us how you were discovered. Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I guess really the moment that I graduated or leveled up, I was a street musician for many years. I started out in my hometown in Halifax, and you know, everybody was getting ready to go off to college and stuff like that, and I didn't have any interest in pursuing an academic life at that point in my life, and I was really in love with music and wanted to see where I could go with it. And so I grabbed my guitar and stuck my thumb in the air, and when I was 17, and you know, my first cities were Vancouver and Toronto, and I was still, you know, underage, you know, at that time. So it was tough for me to get into clubs, but I cut my early teeth on street corners and subway platforms and city parks and stuff like that. And then when I got to be a little bit older, by the time I got to Toronto, I was able to be playing in clubs a little bit. And I just had it for New York. I really wanted to be all the music I was discovering and into at that time, you know, like obviously, as a songwriter, I was really taken with Mr. Dylan, and you know, I discovered John Prine and Leonard Cohen, and you know, the pantheon of great artists that our musical culture has produced in that era. And I was really kind of a music geek, and read about the history of Greenwich Village and places like, you know, where it was happening. Where the incubators that gave us that music, that era of great songwriters. And I wanted to go to New York City and see if that was still there, if that structure still existed. And so without really having any kind of plan, me and a friend of mine who played banjo from Toronto, we by hook or by crook, we made it to New York City. And anyway, you know, endured like some, we got swallowed up in the streets. We didn't have any friends yet. And we ended up living in, you know, with the homeless people and all that stuff. And it was a difficult ride. And, you know, we ended up having to get him back to Toronto, and I stayed in New York on my own and continued on until about midwinter, when it was really like a bitter cold and I was in an abandoned building, and I decided to make a break for New Orleans. You know, I was just learning about, I'm being Canadian. I didn't know all of the vernacular for American cities and stuff. But when I, you know, heard about the Big Easy, I said, well, that sounds good to me, you know? And so we made our way down to, with another friend of mine, we traveled down to New Orleans. And, you know, all through this time I was working side jobs, but, you know, mostly playing. Mostly making my money and paying my way in the world by putting hours in subway platforms and city parks and sidewalks and stuff like that. And working at occasional clubs where they'd have me because I was a newbie, you know, it's hard to get into the situation, especially, you know, in New York, it's very competitive and nobody gets paid until you're up at the top. So it was a rough ride. I split for New Orleans and arrived in New Orleans in the spring of 93. There were street musicians everywhere. There was a whole community there to welcome me, and I very quickly made a lot of friends and had a support structure and, you know, was able to carve a decent life out for myself, playing for tourists on the boardwalk over there, you know, taking shifts, switching up with Tyrone saxophone. And it was a great moment of stability for me. And I got married to a great blues singer, and she was a little older than me and well-versed in the ways of the world and taught me lots about music and otherwise. And I got real good at dodging flying plates and such. She was a blues woman, and, you know, she was very authentic. I mean, she came with a lot of volatile juke joint behavior. But that didn't work out. And when my marriage fell apart, I was back on the street again. And it was at that time, a friend of mine, John Sinclair, who some of your listeners might recognize from John Lennon's work. John Lennon had a song called John Sinclair, John Sinclair, It's Not Fair, John Sinclair. And they put him away. They tried to put him away for 10 years over a couple of joints because he was politically active back in the anti-war era of the Vietnam War. John Sinclair, who your listeners can do their own research on who he is, but he ended up managing the MC. He was managing the MC5 out of Detroit. After John Lennon and Commander Cody and all those folks got together and did that benefit concert to raise money to spring John Sinclair, he went on to become a disc jockey at WWOZ in New Orleans. And so he invited me on the air, and I played a couple tunes on his radio show. And this publisher that was driving through town happened to hear the broadcast and called into the station and said, "Hey, who is that kid that just played those tunes? You know, like, how do we get in touch with him?" And John was like, "Well, I don't think he has a telephone or anything like that, but he's still here in the studio packing up his stuff if you want to talk to him." And so I had a quick parlay with this publisher, and he said, "Well, let's figure out a way to stay in touch, because I'd like to come down there and meet you in person." And they came down a few weeks later with a contract to sign me up to a publishing deal, which meant regular trips to Nashville to cut demos on new material and all that stuff. And some of that early work ended up in front of Rodney Crowell, and Rodney decided to help me level up out of the streets.
Wow. That's fantastic. You know, it's funny. I have this conversation with Richard a couple of times. We've had wonderful musicians on Don't Turn That Dial. I just reintroduced, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mike Younger, a wonderful musician, nationally recognized, internationally famous, and he is coming for one night only to Soho, October 3rd, evening performance, and you better get your tickets now, is all I can tell you. Richard, let's go to quick break. We'll be back in a sec.
Be my ragtime angel. I'll be your easy rolling man. I remember like it was yesterday.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with Mike Younger, who's coming to Soho, one performance only, October the 3rd. Tickets are going fast. It's 8 to, well, sorry, I should say the show is 8 to 10. But those of you who know Soho, you know, my plan is to go and get a dinner table because then you're closer to the performer. But there's also, you know, there's also the patio area. So there is some overflow, but it's not a big venue. A friend of my family, was the president of Columbia Music, Hale Milgram. And Hale lives in Santa Barbara here. And Hale's retired, of course, but he, you know, he discovered, I don't know how many, I guess probably the 60s and the 70s and then into the 80s as president of Columbia Records.
Yeah, I would imagine he oversaw a few careers.
He did. And he does I guess it's four times a year, something like that, at another theater, the Libero. He does kind of a retrospective of the music of his time. And it's kind of an event here in Santa Barbara. But when I get a chance to talk to Hale, I always say, you know, what is it about your ear and your sight and the feel you had for people when you listen to them, you know, that automatically you wanted them for the label? How do you know? How did you know?
What
did he say? You know, he's a very humble guy. He said, I just listened to everything. He, I know he started, we had one of the first, in the early 60s, we had one of the first Tower Records here down by the campus by UCSD, UCSB. And I know Hale, when he was in school, the teenager, he was working for the Tower Records and, you know, selling records to the college kids when he was in high school, and he never stopped listening. And, you know, just went on to just continue to listen. And to this day, he'll ask my partner and I, he and his partner will say, well, you know, we want to see something. We want to see an event. We want to hear some music. As a matter of fact, I want to send him your event, Mike. Yeah, and out of the clear blue, the gentleman is still going strong, still listening. You know, he's not signing people, of course, but he's still actively listening. He's got, I know, an honorary seat at the Santa Barbara Bowl. And he goes to things and he listens and he listens and he listens. You know, it's like there's this famous book about a famous nose in the 18th century that was one of the creators of perfume. They could take chemicals from trees and dust and civet hogs and musk oxes, and they would take these things and they would, by their nose, once they smelled it, they could compose it. But once they composed it, they could also break down the components. So I would think that, you know, people like Rodney Crowell, people you mentioned, Tim Dickman, for example, you know, these people that were discovering you, they have something that we don't have, orally speaking, maybe.
I like to think that there's an authenticity factor, and that people sometimes the miles that you've done shows, and some people know to look for that. You know, I mean, maybe that's too narrow a perspective, but I like to think that it's something that the years that I spent playing on street corners and the struggles that I had in my career were not total wasted and for nothing. That actually created the determination that I have today to keep pushing my career forward. That's why I got down and you know, dug in and pushed it as hard as I could. And that's why I'm still in the game.
So it's interesting to me that your song, Lord of the Fleas, love it. And, you know, I'm an old, what we call an old hoofer, you know, dance background, years of that. But what was so interesting is the risk that you take with, you know, your physicality just to do that video, because you're right up right up flat, you know, flat front and center in the video, singing very, very distinctly, et cetera. Of course, there's little clips that you yourself put in of various, you know, history newsreels, and all sorts of despicable characters show up. But I love that comment you made about that we may not have the terrific oral background that people like Hale Milgram have, or, you know, people like Jim Dickman. We may not have as common folk that, but what we do have is a register somewhere where we can see authenticity. When it's right in front of us, we can see authenticity. And unfortunately, when it's disguised, you get the antithesis of your song, which is, yes, when it's disguised and we're pulled into something that is inauthentic, then we get to meet the Lord of the Fleas, right? So, you know, before we have to go, I want you to talk a little bit about Standing Rock. So you've got, you know, these years of writing songs about the environment and social justice and environmental justice, and you pick up and you go to Standing Rock.
My community was facing an incursion of massive new fossil fuel infrastructure at this very moment in history, where humankind and our civilization's survival depends on us finding a different way to fuel our society. My community in Tennessee was facing massive expansion, and it came at the end of the Obama administration, and the divisions were already really kind of being, our society was beginning to be torn, and divided in a way that none of us had seen yet, at least in this era. And it was something that brought our community together. People on both sides of the spectrum, the political spectrum, were able to agree on this fundamental principle that the creeks that their kids play on shouldn't have, you know, 32-inch diameter interstate pipelines with 750 pounds per square inch of pressure of highly explosive and flammable material corroding half in the creek and half out of the creek with no protective measures, just a totally dilapidated condition in Tennessee. I spent a lot of my Sunday mornings out there in the field photographing river crossings of this pipeline to document how poorly they were being maintained. And we really kind of, as a community, did our best to give a good fight to prevent this thing. And I'm talking about 98% of our community on both sides of the aisle, which is why I really wanted to participate in it, because I felt like the divisions were widening, and the antidote to those divisions is for communities to come together and stick up for each other as a community.
Community-based. You wrote a song, Something in the Air, right?
Yes. Well, the song from the pipeline battle is actually called Poisoned Rivers.
Rivers. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's from Little Folks Like You and Me in 2017. And, you know, our community came together, we put up a good fight, and it was right around the same time that the Dakota Access Pipeline was that whole incident and confrontation was happening out in North Dakota. And, you know, tribes around all of the Americas, North, South, and Central America and the Pacific Islands, all came to the side of the Lakota Sioux in solidarity. And a demonstration of what a people that prioritize the preservation of the natural world for future generations, what that can look like, and how powerful we can be when we come together to say, you know, no, this is as far as it can go. You can't go further than this, you know. And although the Standing Rock struggle to prevent a massive new pipeline in 2017, when our civilization's on, you know, the survival of our civilization, once again, it depends on us finding a different form of fuel for our civilization. The people of Standing Rock, who have been violated and had their rights and their lands usurped and have been disrespected and trampled and criminally marginalized in the United States repeatedly, those people were once again facing a similar type of thing, because their water infrastructure is very, very meager, very humble. They barely have potable water out there. Their only potable water is the river that has now been subject to spills even since that construction in 2017. And the company said, oh, there will never be a spill on this pipeline. And all this thing. I mean, it's just, you know, whoever would have guessed there might be an issue, you know, like what could have, you know, who could have ever predicted that there might be an oil spill? Well, the Lakota Sioux said something about that in the run-up to the confrontation that could happen. And at any rate, my community was so embroiled in our own pipeline battle that we felt a solidarity. I was able to, myself and a number of other Greens in Nashville, people who were, you know, had climate issues on their mind, were able to organize a series of events and fundraisers and, you know, for people to donate material. And the people of Tennessee donated what they had. And we went with winter camping gear and crates of potatoes and a livestock trailer full of hogs. And, I mean, you know, yeah, the Hawaiians that came in solidarity to Standing Rock, they were, you know, holding ceremony and conducting luau's. And although the hogs never ended up, the ones that I brought, you know, I brought them with the intention to feed that 5,000 person or 10,000 person camp. I learned that they had a place in the camp because they didn't have, a compost bin, and there was a lot of spoiling food and the pigs, they had a great time. And they kept the camp from developing rodents and all that stuff. So there was an interactive relationship that was more important than just having a pig roast. So the pigs actually ended up getting set free out there at the end of that thing when the private army that was hired by the oil and gas finally raided the camp. So the people in camp set those pigs free. So hopefully they got away.
Wow. Well, it's what a story, you know, it's such a survival story. We hope that we can use that as an example. It's so interesting because, you know, what can a song do? I mean, honestly, what can a song do to, you know, solidify such a fight? Well, it can do a lot. And here's proof.
I'm sorry. I wanted to add to this story of Standing Rock because if I have a minute more to speak on that, they called us to the Seven Councils fire at the center of the camp on like the fourth day that we were there, myself and the gentleman that I was traveling with, and they wanted us to announce ourselves and to tell the people in camp why we had come, and they put us on the loudspeaker, and all around us is thousands of teepees and camps. And Mac was nervous and he said, you better do the talking, Mike. And I stepped up to the microphone and I said that we had come on behalf of the people of Tennessee who threw their support behind the efforts of Standing Rock and had sent us with material to support them in their efforts because their enemy at this moment with the Black Snake and the Dakota Access Pipeline was the same enemy that we were fighting back home. And when we announced that, the drummers started drumming and the dancers started dancing and the singers started singing. And it made my hair stand on end, and it was one of the most amazing moments of my life.
And who was singing and dancing?
There was tribal singers. They had a ceremonial fire at the center of camp, and they had assembled a drum circle of elders, and they had assembled the dancers and the singers. And it wasn't just a show; it was a ceremony. It was a very serious ceremony celebrating the gathering of the tribes. It's quite an amazing thing to behold.
Yeah. So the power of that is pretty, a pretty fantastically amazing. You know, we don't know each other, Mike, but my best friend for 42 years is Ute, and, you know, has a really close connection to his people, but he also, he lives in Seattle, basically, and he's an activist for Native American people in Seattle. And I've been to many ceremonies over 42 years. I know what you're talking about. It's pretty powerful stuff. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. Back with Mike Younger in a second.
My beautiful friend, what can I say? I let you slip away, my beautiful friend.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I have the pleasure of speaking with musician, songwriter, I don't know what else, singer, composer, guitarist, world tramp, and the person who walks the walk. Just before we have to go, I want to just make sure everybody knows this beautiful, handsome performer, musician, composer, activist, poet, social guru, social leader, and a pretty fantastic singer, guitarist is coming to Soho October the 3rd. You got to get your tickets now. The performance starts at 8. Try to see if you can get a table and get in there, around 7 or so. That's what I plan to do. I really appreciate you stopping the van, Mike, and speaking to us on your way to another gig. You're in the middle of the Midwest now, and you're heading Nashville, Minnesota. Good luck on that. And, I mentioned, Richard, it's funny, I mentioned to Mike, he's such a handsome thing, and I love watching him in his little short jacket with his gorgeous long legs, and he was carrying his old beat-up guitar case. He was on the road again kind of thing in one of his videos, and I said before we started this interview, you got to get out there and have somebody take a picture, but oh, wait a minute, it's Iowa. Maybe not. Oh, wait.
I've seen some beautiful country out here in Iowa while I've been here.
Okay, well, we need to see that on an album or a video.
I'll try and snap a photo.
Yeah, this one fan. It's a request from Elizabeth Stewart. One fan is making that request.
I'm going to tag you on that one.
I want to see those long legs and that beautiful guitar case traipsing through the Iowa sunset.
it's almost starting to happen.
Oh, good. Hey, Richard, thank you very much. And Mike, we're looking forward to seeing you October 3rd. Mike Younger, take a look at all of his music on YouTube. You're going to love it. You'll love his message. He's made for us because, we're the founders of Earth Day. That's a lot of, good percentage of his message is wake up and look at the earth is pretty much kind of what he's here to do. Thanks, Mike.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Elizabeth.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Bye.
My only shelter from the cold.